This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Coming up, Solomon Islands government under fire for using the Pacific Games as an excuse to try and delay the 2023 election. The Kiribati government faces a wave of criticism over moves to allow commercial fishing in one of the world's largest marine reserves, and how cutting down the amount of contact on the rugby field could open the door for Pacific skills to shine. Those stories to come, but first, the Australian government is reviewing its campaign aimed at stopping Pacific seasonal workers from absconding from their jobs. While around 12,000 have come into Australia over the past year from Vanuatu, Samoa, Tonga and Solomon Islands, as many as 1,000 have since fled to take up other work. But as Talia Olatia reports, the government's prevention campaign has come under fire from critics who say it's created a climate of fear and shame among the Pacific workforce.
A poster with a worker with his head in his hands and a warning: if you abscond, you will bring shame to your family.
It is fear-driven. Every word on that thing is fear-driven. There is no compassion.
Jeff Smith is a pastoral care worker in Bundaberg who's looked after Vanuatu workers for more than a decade. His property was raided by Australian Border Force a few months ago as a part of an ongoing investigation into missing seasonal workers. Mr. Smith says people are only leaving because of the harsh and exploitative work conditions.
We learned about the tragedy of these 22 workers from Vanuatu that came over here. They were working for 3 months. Not received any pay. They were sleeping on the side of roads. They were sleeping in houses, crammed into one house. They were sleeping in hostel type accommodation, and all they were doing was paying for the accommodation.
Thousands of Pacific workers have filled labour shortages here in Australia during the pandemic, travelling from Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Samoa, Tonga and Fiji. While the majority of them are on the ground working on farms, at least 10% are reported to have fled their jobs with employers who are approved as part of the Australian Government Worker Program. Mike Rose is a researcher at the Australian National University and also questions the government's approach.
Instead of reaching out to workers with sympathy, trying to understand where they're coming from and address the root causes of why someone might be uneasy, providing maybe more information on the resources and that are available to them, their rights, what we saw was essentially a scare campaign. There is this 24-hour hotline for worker welfare. Why couldn't have that been on the poster? I certainly didn't say it there. Are workers aware that in Australia they have every right to complain if their work conditions are not the same as those promised to them, which they, you know, they are protected under the law? Like, why was that not on the poster?
The campaign poster was translated into 5 Pacific languages, including Solomon Islands Pidgin, the Timorese language Tetan, and Vanuatu's Bizlama, but they are now no longer available on the government's website. A spokesperson from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade told the ABC it's reviewing the images and text following external feedback. It also says they will consult with Pacific and Timor-Leste partners to develop communications under the scheme. Mike Rose hopes their concerns will be taken on board.
If the government really values its relationship with the Pacific and the great work being done by Pacific workers, we can only hope that they're listening to the criticisms that are rightfully being levelled at them right now.
He says while the government may be backtracking on its campaign, the problem of absconding workers continues to grow, with some applying for asylum.
Someone who applies for a protection visa onshore in Australia is usually granted a bridging visa while the Department of Home Affairs looks to resolve their case, which can take up to 2 or 3 years, during which time people are able to work where they like. So you can see why that's a tempting option for some.
Farmers and industry groups have complained, saying they've spent money on expensive charters to fly in Pacific workers and also pay their quarantine costs, only to lose workers within weeks. They claim dodgy labour hire firms are luring workers away and want the government to impose tough sanctions against workers who abscond. But Mr. Smith in Bundaberg wants a better approach, and he believes workers won't jump ship if work conditions are up to standard, fit for Australian workers.
The biggest problem that we've got is dishonesty in the whole situation. Workers want to get their crops off. I mean, contractors and farmers want to get their crops off as cheaply as they can. We know there is a lot of good contractors, and we know that there's a lot of good farmers. We realise that. But we realise there's a hell of a lot of crooks.
Pastoral care worker Jeff Smith from Bundaberg ending that report from Talia Olatia. The Solomon Islands government wants to postpone the next national election so that the hosting of the 2023 Pacific Games can take centre stage. Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare has told the Electoral Commission that voter registration won't be possible while the Games are in town. And right now, the government is contemplating whether to make the switch a one-off or to change the constitution so that in future, elections will be held every 5 years rather than four. Leading opposition figure Peter Canaloria Jr. has condemned the government's strategy as a very bad idea. Mr. Canaloria says the hosting of the Pacific Games in Honiara is not a good enough reason to delay an election, and he's accused the government of being too focused on the region's biggest multi-sports event.
That is all well and good in terms of all those spin-offs that might come economically, but I think our constitution, as it stands, should be respected. And this idea currently is unconstitutional. We still have a four-year term, and that term runs from the first meeting of Parliament, which was back in 2019 after the last elections. So changing midstream in terms of constitutional change really is something that many of us have very, very big issues on.
Prime Minister Sogavare does have the political numbers to alter the constitution potentially. But in your mind, does this then set a dangerous precedent?
Very much so. And coming into the elections, this idea of extension was never mandated. Nobody ran on this as a party or even as independents. To have it now become an issue midstream is something that is very, very unfair. And many of us think that it is an attempt to continue to stay in power and then using the games as an excuse. We feel that there's a lot of time to have the elections as well as enjoy the games later that year in November 2023.
Now, what has the reaction been like from the public, and what have some of your constituents been telling you about this proposal?
For us, it's very clear we cannot have an extension of this parliament. The support for that particular position is widespread. My own constituency is against this. I have had consultations already, and I'll be having more consultations with my own constituency. But other people in public, yesterday I was in town and I met three people just walked up to me. Strangers and just saw me, recognized me, and told me that they were not in support of this, very passionately so. So it's something that is in the minds of many of our people already. They don't want to see this continuing. Many are saying this is an attempt to hijack our democratic processes and set a bad precedent going forward. So this is something that's very serious for us, and the public is very much aware of it. And I think they will be making their voices heard if the government continues to push this. Of course, the numbers are there, but I think there are bigger considerations. And I would think that if there's an idea to do an extension, then campaign on that in the next election and then have the mandate to come in and do that.
What will you and the opposition group do to oppose this, and how might you go about that?
I questioned it in Parliament. It was perhaps a slip of the tongue by the Prime Minister because he was answering a different question, but then he let that in. So I heard it and I followed up with a question. And at that time, the answer was that they were doing consultations. There was a paper, a study that's going to be done. And apparently there was no decision yet when there was a leaked decision already by Cabinet. So those initial comments and circumstances surrounding it has given us room for concern in terms of what the real agenda is here. But for us, the concern is that consultations are already being done with the premiers of the provinces. They're looking to have consultations with our Chamber of Commerce, with our churches. So this is very much in the mind of the government. And for many of us, with the history of this current government, they might say there's consultations, but it's already been cooked. There is clear political will by this government to push this through.
Opposition MP Peter Canaloria Jr. on the line from Honiara, and he was speaking there to Marla Damadi. The climate minister for Tuvalu, Seve Painui, was in the room when the COP26 pact was signed and sealed in Glasgow. He says there was certainly some progress made with dialogue on the 1.5-degree global warming target still alive, adaptation finance doubled, and a first mention in a COP agreement about the use of coal. But Mr. Painoi says the last-minute watering down of the wording from phase out to phase down the use of coal was a big blow to all the Pacific Island nations.
I was in disbelief, lost for words, because the presidency all along had instructed the conference that there won't be any scope for any further proposed changes to the text. So when we adjourned before everybody came back to adopt the outcomes, we had that understanding that there wouldn't be any further changes and phase out would still be retained. So when India and China brought up the issue and to reopen the text for debate, everybody was in disbelief, very disappointed, dismayed, disheartened that the hard work we had put in over the last 2 weeks just got changed in the last minute.
Some groups have described this as a betrayal of developing countries. Do you feel that strongly?
Yes, we could clearly see that the US was brokering that deal. The US was transversing back and forth between India and China and some other countries like Brazil, trying to get a compromise language that would be acceptable to those countries. Everybody else was left in the dark.
Minister, countries like Australia came to COP26 without any changes to the emission targets for 2030. Do you think the Glasgow Pact will mean that they'll have to come back next year with higher emission targets?
The commitments and the targets reached here in Glasgow still fall short of the 1.5 trajectory. So there's a whole lot of work that is still needed after Glasgow to get the existing countries who have made those commitments to deliver, but also to raise their ambition, like, for instance, Australia. And then we've got another set of countries like China and in India who have pushed back their timetable for cutting emissions, offshooting the 1.5 degree threshold. So there's a whole lot of work left to bring those countries back on board in terms of the 1.5.
Seve Painui, Tuvalu's Minister for Climate Change, on the line from COP26 in Glasgow, and he was speaking to Evan Wasuka. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Former Kiribati President Anote Tong, who helped to set up his country's huge protected marine reserve, is not at all happy with the current government's plan to open it up for commercial fishing. After cabinet papers outlining its intentions were leaked to the media, the Kiribati government has confirmed it wants to open up the Phoenix Island protected area to foreign fishing vessels as a way of generating more revenue. But as Dubrovka Volodea reports, Mr. Tong believes it's a very bad idea, and his view that migratory fish species will suffer is supported by marine scientists.
The Phoenix Island protected area is a fertile zone for many fish and a rich spawning ground. It has been a no-take area since 2015, which means commercial fishing boats have been banned. But the Office of the President has confirmed that the Kiribati government is planning to open up the area to sustainable commercial fishing. It says it will aim to protect its marine resources and at the same time make money from fishing.
Our decision as a sovereign country and government is people-centric and commensurate with holistic options for marine protection and management, economic diversification, sustainable tourism and fisheries to promote the growth of Kiribati's blue economy and uplift the lives of all Kiribati.
At this stage, it's unclear whether the decision will affect the area's UNESCO status, since the president's office is yet to provide any further comment. Former president Anote Tong was a key player in establishing the protected zone, and he's disappointed that the fertile area will be opened up to fishing boats.
Government is under severe pressure to generate revenue because of its rather exorbitant budget. I thought that there were other ways of doing it rather than opening the marine protected area, for the reason that I think it's been proven scientifically that it's the fertile spawning grounds for the targeted species. And so that in itself is disappointing. It's still in the stages of being fully assessed. Its contribution to sustainability could be fully assessed. So it is a bit disappointing. After all the trouble that we went to list it as a World Heritage Site.
Opposition leader Tessie Lamburn says as far as she's aware, the plan is yet to be tabled in Parliament, which won't sit again until later this month.
The government has not made any submission for the Parliament or a bill to repeal the People Conservation Trust Act. And I think that's an important first step if they wanted to dismantle PIPA. There's this quite a number of procedures that they would need to follow before they can make their decision or for their decision to take effect.
Ms. Lamburn says she hopes the government will maintain the area's protected status as it's been a global model for marine conservation. Mr. Tong echoes that concern, saying many questions remain unanswered.
Could it remain as a credible World Heritage Site when it's being fully commercialized? Okay, I think these are the questions that remain unanswered at the moment, and I think the propositions that have been put forward is to try to avoid it being delisted. And I think it can still be done. I would have preferred maybe a step-by-step approach rather than a total delisting at this time, unless, of course, government has other plans for using not only that area, but the rest of the Phoenix Islands themselves.
The government statement says that years after the protected area was established, it wasn't generating enough money to meet the country's needs. But Mr. Tong says there could have been other ways to generate more cash flow, since the zone is such a fertile ground for many species, including tuna.
I've always believed in actually enhancing our participation in the industry in order that we might maximize our return on the fishery, rather than taking out more of the resource. There are many models around the world, but of course, the one that I am aware of, what they do in Iceland, where they actually got down the volume taken out of the fishery, but actually multiplied the return many times more, because what they did was get a higher rate of return. In other cases, enhance their participation in the industry by processing, by harvesting. And so these are the many things that we need to explore.
The Pacific Community's principal fisheries scientist, Dr. Simon Nicol, says the effect of opening up could be damaging to some extent.
Whilst its overall impacts on tuna recruitment and population dynamics are perhaps not so significant, it's likely to be quite significant for a range of other pelagic species. So particularly animals that hang around or orientate themselves around seamounts, or have very, very restrictive ranges, then the Phoenix Islands protected area does offer a level of conservation support for those species.
Kiribati is a member of the parties to the Nauru government, which controls how much tuna can be fished. So Dr. Nicol says that should help prevent overfishing.
That overall limit is controlled. So in that respect, I don't see that there's likely to be any impact on the tuna populations through the reopening of the Phoenix Islands protected area for sustainable commercial fishing.
He says he does not expect that industrial-style fisheries will open up in the island state. UNESCO says it cannot comment before they hear from their partners.
That report from Dubrovka Volodea. And finally, for this edition of Pacific Review, new guidelines issued by World Rugby on contact training have been well received in the Pacific. While Ireland players have a reputation for thriving on high-impact collisions, the belief now is that limiting contact in training will have a positive effect come match day. The feeling is that if the World Rugby guidelines are followed, the special skills of the Pacific players, both men and women, will come to the fore. For a number of years now, World Rugby has been keen to find ways of reducing injury rates and particularly head injuries. In match play, a number of changes have been made to scrums and mauls, and now the aim is to limit the amount of contact to which players are subjected on the training field. Under the new guidelines, there are weekly limits of 15 minutes for full contact training, 40 for controlled contact, and 30 minutes for set pieces. The guidelines have been drafted on the back of feedback from 600 elite male and female players, as well as specialists in strength and conditioning, medicine and high performance. Surprisingly, the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Organisation wasn't consulted, but Chief Executive Dan Leo is still supportive of World Rugby's strategy.
I remember when I was at Wasps, I'd be dressed up as Tuilangi on my back, and you know, because it was just the only likelihood we shared was where we had Samoan bloodlines, then I was basically just a tackle bag for 2 hours. And the days of that are gone, you know. I think way too much of the focus has been on the contact area and on collisions. Hopefully, if we're scaling that back in training, it'll have more emphasis and time for teams to develop tactics and skills.
Talamo Wonga is regional training manager for Oceania Rugby, and he says he will certainly be encouraging coaches to stick to the guidelines because the past injury rate in training has been too high.
They are there to assist coaches to realize what they are doing with the contact loading overall. So not only the intensity, the volume, and even sometimes the density of loading, so that when they are in either full contact or even in controlled contact situations, we would like them to adhere to some of these guidelines.
Over in Samoa, Filoi Analiko has a foot in both camps as coach of senior men's team Apollo, and right now she's in charge of the Women's Rugby Academy.
It's a useful guideline to plan in advance on how to cater the needs and wants of the players' welfare, not only for now, but for the future and also after their playing career. So for women's rugby here in Samoa, it's something that we have already introduced. So yeah, game development for women's here with the new guideline is good because it all covers different varieties of trainings, and it will make the coaches think of new ideas and be creative on what kind of trainings they need to cover to achieve what they want without getting the players injured.
So what should we read into the fact that the guidelines for men and women are the same? Is it a sign that the women's game is getting tougher?
World Rugby does not like to differentiate between the women and the men's game so much. We understand there are differences, but when we do coaching level 2 or SNC level 2, it is the same. We need to treat the women's with respect. So it's not giving them a second choice. In the olden days, there is a women way of doing it. There's a men's way of doing it, but in rugby, tackle is a tackle.
World Rugby have been big on equality across the board, and gender equality has been a massive topic. I think to have two separate laws would have opened up a bit of a can of worms. I think it's a lot easier, particularly at the formation of these laws, to have one blanket rule. We're not saying that anything should be set in stone. Rugby's adapting. Rules need to be fluid for the betterment of the game, but also for the safety of the game.
At the root of what's happening, Filoi Analiko says there's the aim to train players in the art of avoiding unnecessary contact.
Coaches have to consider the amount of time players need to recover before they load them with another physical session. It's a mindset for both men's and women's to avoid contact if it's not necessary. Only go into contact if they need, but play smart and look for space to create tries.
My hope is that it'll just change the game, open it up, make it quicker. And we've already seen that happen. You know, look at England when they played Tonga, the skill and the pace that they played the game with, and there were some big contacts. That's never going to be taken out of rugby, bro. But I think the game is changing for better. You know, I'm not saying we need to roll back the clock here, but you know, when you look at rugby from what it was in the 80s and 90s to what it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, it was two different sports.
Where the Pacific may be behind the eight ball is on monitoring the effect of the new guidelines. In the Northern Hemisphere, some teams have agreed to use what are described as instrumented mouthguards, but such technology won't be available in the Pacific for some time yet.
Not only in New Zealand, Australia, but in the Pacific Islands. So it all depends on the availability of these high-tech equipments, and as such, we do play our part in there. If after the testing, sometimes they give us to roll out to a few member units, and hopefully Australia, New Zealand would be able to pick up on that. But at the moment, most of them are in the control tournaments up north, but we do share in our testing. I'm not aware of this one.
Where the contact guidelines may have a big impact is on the female game at junior levels. Filoi Analiko says in Samoa there are already signs that parents who were previously reluctant to let their daughters play rugby are being won round.
These guidelines will give the girls and also the mothers understand what we are doing here in our rugby program, and will give them time because most of the girls are still in school. So now the parents and the mother understand, okay, if my daughter is going to the academy, she is also covering some of the schoolwork here in the academy. So, and more awareness program about the new guideline. So now the mothers agree for their daughters to come and play rugby because they now rely on us to look after their daughters when they come into the academy.
As World Rugby's recommended training strategy is rolled out across the Pacific, Talamoanga expects to see fewer injuries and better players. And Filoi Analiko says it's all about playing smart, an area perhaps where the men could actually learn from the women.
The level of contact in women's game compared to the men's game is the same, but the only difference is the males are more muscular than girls. However, the girls play smart, so they avoid contact most of the time. And that is how I paced my trainings. So because of the tactical side of the game in terms of set pieces and also building face to create spaces for them to score points, that's the only reason why they go into contact.
if they are loaded the right way, optimum performance will occur, and I think the game will become better. There will be better, fitter, more functional athletes coming out at the end.
That's Oceania Rugby's regional training manager, Talamo Wonga, rounding out this edition of Pacific Review. A reminder, you can listen to the program on demand by subscribing to our podcast. And we'll be back next weekend with a roundup of some more key stories making headlines in the Pacific. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thank you very much for listening.